Thank you, Dr. Kent. That was very enlightening. I learned quite a bit there. There's a lot of food for thought. If you found Dr. Kent's lecture of interest, you might want to consider taking a course with her in the spring. She will be teaching U.S. women's history as well as U.S. history from 1877. Other topics she teaches include female activism in the U.S., fashion history in the U.S., history of the family in the U.S., oral history, slavery and abolition in the United States, as well as women and gender in the U.S. South. Additional readings and research on the 19th Amendment can be found in Brookings Library. We'll be sure you have this as a handout in your 301 class. Now that we have some background on the 19th Amendment, the activism surrounding it, and its eventual passage, we would like to turn to the panel portion of today's event. Here to introduce our panelists is my co-coordinator of this ECHA event, Rexanne Wharton, director of the UIS Women's Center.
Hello, everybody. That was a really amazing talk we just heard, and I learned a lot as well. So I'm really excited to introduce our panelists today. So the first person I'd like to introduce is Deanie Brown. She serves our university as the Associate Chancellor of Access and Equal Opportunity. Thank you, Deanie.
Thank you, Rex.
Our next person is Catherine Eisenhart. She is a faculty emeritus from the UIS Legal Studies Department. Thank you. Our next person is Tiffany Saunders, who is a lecturer in our sociology and anthropology department. Thank you, Tiffany. Next is Aureli Valeria. She's a graduate student in human development counseling and a recent undergraduate. She just graduated in 2020. And finally, a new face on our campus, Karen Whitney, who is now serving as our interim chancellor. Thank you so much. So for our first question, and you know, so this is unstructured. I know there's a chance someone might start talking, and so we'll just kind of roll with if we talk over each other a little bit, the awkwardness of it, and we'll move on after that. But our first question is that more modern feminist thinkers have pointed out that feminist history is often taught in a way that applies to white middle or upper class women's history more than anything, than to like women as a collective, which I think Dr. Kent touched on a lot in her lecture. Based on this lecture, what new history did you personally learn tonight, and what surprised you?
I'm going to start just because nobody else unmuted, so I'm going to start. Actually, just being invited to be on the panel led me, like lawyers and scholars do, to start looking up things. So because of what was going to be happening, I started reading, and then all of that, a lot of what I read was reinforced by the lecture, which is Black women were totally left out. I mean, they were there, they were fighting, but too bad, so sad. You know, it was like, they aren't women. I mean, I don't know what was, but I live in today's world and not in that world. And so that was one of the most surprising things that I learned, along with some information about Alice Paul, but I'll save that for later.
Well, and thank you so much for that. I really enjoyed Dr. Kent's talk. It, as a fellow historian of sorts, it wasn't new information for me, but it's always important to hear it. But when we talk about then versus now, one of the things that always occurs to me, particularly in my role in access and equal opportunity, is the persistence of the phrase women and minorities. We often hear that, you know, sort of categorizes us when we're considering underrepresentation or, you know, the adequacy of our numbers when we deal with diversity as a quantitative sort of measurement. And so that the mere phrase women and minorities sort of locates women as not having a race or ethnicity, any identity, or minorities as not having a gender. And what it really operates as is a code or shorthand, so that women, by and large, means white women. And so I think even now, even though, you know, we're well past the era of the 1920s, and I know we're going to get into other histories and what they mean to us, I think often there's still that coded language that we sort of have normalized.
I'm going to jump in there too. So I'm a sociologist with sort of a foundation in Black feminist thought. So there wasn't necessarily a ton of like new information because of that. But what I've always found interesting in thinking about Black feminism is this notion that a lot of the things that suffragists were actually fighting for were things that Black women were already doing. So Black women have almost always had to do things like work while taking care of children, typically in the white women's homes. So it's just always this really interesting juxtaposition for me that suffragists were fighting for these things and sort of ignoring the role of the women who, the very women in their homes who were embodying some of these roles and identities that they were trying to take on and fighting to take on as well. So there's a real interesting sort of, I don't know, I like to call it cognitive dissonance when, you know, to use a psychological term, that you can have these things happening in your own lives and not understand how the people who are involved in these things might also maybe need your support and maybe need a voice. I will say that the one thing that was interesting in Dr. Kent's talk that I hadn't really thought about is this notion of anti-suffragist, right? Because we do tend to think of the suffrage movement as like, all the women wanted this, like that's sort of the grand narrative. And so to think about like some women not wanting this and the sort of justification for not wanting it being things like, I'm already influencing, you know, the vote through my husband and through my sons. But it's not really shocking for me because there was that new historical book that came out that's titled in part, They Were Her Property. And it talks specifically about the role of white women in slavery and how we tend to think of white women in the slavery movement as sort of a passive part of it. But this book essentially makes the argument that they played a very active role in the institution of slavery and in upholding the institution of slavery. So if you look at sort of that book as part of this longer narrative, then it makes perfect sense that there'll be some white women who wouldn't want, for instance, the right to vote.
I think something that Dr. Kent's story, it reminds me of a couple of things, probably I have to just say because it's the most talk about this moment today that we're here is you talked about an era from 1848 to 1920. And in 2020, we have a woman who is running for vice president of the United States who is a Black woman. And that is monumental. And I have to just say it. And I want to say it because I'm so thrilled. I think it does bring to me, though, that I always go back at this point in life of what progress have we made and what progress do we have yet to make. And it's just push and pull and push and pull and push and pull. And some days I think, you guys, I think we're in the plus column, and some days I'm not so sure. I'll be honest with you. But yet as a lifetime educator, I keep pushing forward. So I'm just had to articulate the excitement and pride in this moment in 2020 as we reflect back on 1920, because I think we do need to never forget the past and the history, because it's still with us today. It's still part of the baggage and the legacy in our space. And sometimes I'm stunned on how much it is, because there were similar eras in the 1970s with the ERA where women were tearing themselves apart. Today, I do a lot of work in leadership today and women in leadership. And I call out how women still don't support women. and we can divide it on lots of lines. And Dr. Kent today gave us an excellent discussion of how white women would not support women of color, Black women. And today we still have those issues of women not supporting women. And I think there's some things that, again, have changed, and amazingly, some things are the same. So that's the best I can do on my talk, but I think that's where my head's at, and I'll probably spend the next couple of days thinking about Dr. Kent's talk. So thank you.
I think for me, I was, you know, very much aware that even though the 19th Amendment did pass, it did not mean that it was a full liberation for all women, because obviously women of color weren't, you know, given the same rights at that time. And that wasn't surprising to me. But I think what was surprising and what I did learn is that, you know, that the white suffrage movement was, you know, recruiting predominantly white women, and that they were pushing the idea that enfranchisement of women's rights to vote would perpetuate the white supremacy that was happening in the world. And so to me, like, that, I didn't know about that. And I also didn't know that Frederick Douglass was also one of the first to really support women in this fight.
I was muted. Thank you for those great responses. Really appreciate your all's insight so far. So this is a personal question for all of you, but outside of the 19th Amendment, what would you consider to be the most significant piece of legislation or court decision, or maybe even just an event that has impacted your life as a woman, and why would you categorize it that way?
So colleagues, I thought about this with the questions, the wonderful questions that that we were asked to contemplate. And of course, you know, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which sort of ushered in, it not necessarily secured the right for Black people to vote, but at least ushered in the idea. But I think as important as that legislation is, I really think the Black Power movement, at least, you know, in my experience and my observation, was a real catalyst. And, you know, the idea that there was pride to be claimed, that there was something to be demanded, the agency and urgency surrounding that. I think the Black Power movement was truly cataclysmic. Obviously, the legislation sort of moved along state-sanctioned discrimination, at least as an ideal. But I just had the opportunity to listen in on a webinar. Actually, I saw it in our campus announcements. Dr. Hinda Seif entered in campus announcements the opportunity to look at a book launch. Our University of Illinois Press had just published a book by an academic, a Black woman scholar, and she had this awesome concept, know your place aggression. So it's sort of a subset of microaggressions. You know, we talk about that, the fact that, you know, these things happen, it may not always be overt, but which feel like harm, and therefore we feel wounded, and we term them aggressions. So this idea of know your place aggression, that, you know, there's a penalty associated with success, a penalty associated with claiming the value and worth that you either as an individual or as a collective pursue. So I think for me that the movement was as impactful as the legislation, if not more so.
I also spent quite a bit of time thinking about this. And because I teach a little bit about this as well, I think, you know, a lot of times we think about like Title IX as one sort of piece of legislation that's really impacted women. But I also like to think of affirmative action in this way. I mean, we tend to associate affirmative action with race. And a lot of our critique of affirmative action is on the grounds of race, but the actual legislation just says we have to increase opportunities in you know, where women or where groups were historically not afforded opportunities. And so affirmative action has in many ways been implemented to benefit women. And as I was growing up, this led to things, programs like Women in Science and other things that were meant to really expose groups, in this particular women, from exposed them to opportunities that they didn't have. So we've seen this move when, with regards to sciences and technology, so that's the STEM, mathematics, those sort of disciplines. But what I think has also been really important from a scholarly perspective is that we're also critiquing the implementation of affirmative action policies with regard to race and ethnicity. And what scholars have found is this has disproportionately benefited white women. And so I think yet again, we're seeing this sort of gender or this racial disparity, even in a policy that's meant to sort of equalize the sort of sex and gender playing field. So I've always found that very interesting. And I've always found it interesting that we've attacked affirmative action almost exclusively from the standpoint of race and not really attacked it from the same standpoint of sex and gender. So it's just almost exclusively. So not totally, but like almost, you know, the University of Michigan case, all these other cases are exclusively about race when it comes to affirmative action. So
Dr. Saunders, I'm sorry to jump in again. That is so important. I mean, as an affirmative action officer, yes, that executive order, that enactment at the that came from President Johnson, mm-hmm. absolutely was the biggest catalyst for introducing white women into the professional workforce in ways where they weren't stereotyped like Mad Men, you know, where you had to be a secretary or office worker. And in fact, that phrase, women and minorities, came out of that whole affirmative action movement. And yes, even though we don't say white women, and maybe that's why the phrase women and minorities, you know, became popularized, because it's never truly been acknowledged that affirmative action was the biggest driver that gave opportunity for white women to step out of those roles that Dr. Kent mentioned, you know, the idea that a place for women was only in the home as a mother and wife. And yes, thanks so much for that. That's so important.
I think for me, one of the things that has come up a lot recently is like Roe versus Wade, and how, you know, there's a lot of people who don't believe that, you know, women should, or like, not that people don't believe, but I feel like women are being governed, like their bodies are being governed, and we deserve to have that autonomy over ourselves. And there's laws being made about women's bodies and no laws absolutely governing men's bodies. And so I think that for me, knowing that I have the right to certain things like abortion is very, very important. And so I think that's one of the biggest things that I thought about when it comes to this question, is being able to make decisions and decisions over my body. So
I'm going to jump in before Chancellor Whitney jumps in, just because my ignorance about the 19th Amendment is fairly profound. I was obviously born after the 19th Amendment was passed, and it was there, and I didn't, you know, I really didn't think about any of that as a young person until quite a bit later in my life. But I still think the legislation that it had the most impact on my life personally and the lives of women my age who were born during the World War II or just after World War II was the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And other people might look at that and have, I mean, other But for me, that is the piece of legislation that I think impacted me personally. And I will talk about it when we get to C, because I have a story to tell on C. And now I will mute.
Yeah, I don't have much to add, because I agree with the different civil rights acts that have been noted, Title IX. What I can tell you in a 40-year career in higher ed is how the march toward justice is slow, very slow. And the iterations of Title IX and the Civil Rights Act is very slow, and it doesn't always go forward, it goes backwards. I do want to give a shout out to the appreciation of what you've described so far and how I believe it has affected LGBT rights in this country. And there's a lot, and as an out lesbian who, you know, has benefited from these the legislation, because in many ways the foundational documents you've talked about so far influenced the advancement of civil rights for LGBTQ. Different, very different, different histories, different narratives. There is the connecting point, though, on the fundamentals of human rights. And so I do want to give a shout out on that connection. And it just reminds me how we're extraordinarily connected together. And it also reminds me in you know, human identity. And as it said, that, you know, none of us are just one thing. None of us are all women. We all have multiple identities, and each of these identities have narratives and histories and storied in the things we're talking about. So I do want to give a sincere appreciation that it's the total advancement of civil rights, and how, if you know the history, one layers and supports another and supports another. And it's important to, I think, for the gratitude and appreciation of that.
Thank you. So this next question I'm really excited about. In your youth, what do you feel was expected of you on the basis of your gender? And how do you feel those expectations are different than for young women today?
Okay, so I guess I'll go. So for me, I'm 22. I just graduated with my bachelor. So I feel like I'm pretty much in those like really young years, like my 20s, that are so important. And I think for me, when I think about this question, it just reminds me of the role of the woman as like a mother and as a caregiver. Because for me, you know, one of my family members recently got married, and that sprung a lot of conversations about, you know, marriage for me and children for me. And so a lot of those conversations for me are like kind of scary, because I'm more focused on my education, and I'm not really focused on marriage or having children at this age. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but I feel like there's this expectation, especially in my culture, to get married young, to have children young, and that's not what I want. And so for me, I feel like I am not following the gender norms or the gender roles of my culture, but, you know, I'm living, you know, I'm a first generation American, so my parents are immigrants. And so for me, there's a lot of things that are different in my life than in the lives of like my cousins who are around my age, or family members who, you know, are still living in Belize. And so everything that I do is a little different, but that's okay.
Maybe I'll go next, and we can go and like reverse in like age chronological order. Does that sound fun? No, I'm just kidding. I really feel like, so my parents were children of the 70s. And so I really feel like that impacted how they raised myself and my two sisters. I'm the oldest of three girls. So I think that also makes a huge difference as well. So I'm a child of the 80s, however. I just told you my age a little bit. And so I I really feel like there was not a lot of pressure put on us with regard to sort of traditional gender norms. In fact, it was the exact opposite. It was my parents, and especially my mom, really instilling in us that the world was really our oyster and that we didn't have to live up the, sort of these traditional gender norms, and pushing us to really focus on like ourselves and building ourselves and our own accomplishments before sort of thinking about what our lives needed to look like with, for instance, a partner if we chose to have one, and those sorts of things. So I really feel like what was instilled in us was a much more flexible approach to I'm going to say womanhood in this particular instance. And I really think it has to do with when they were coming up as well. So being born in the 60s, growing up in the 70s during, you know, more feminist movements, the Black Power movement. So we have all of these things happening, I think, simultaneously in my parents' lives that ultimately impacted us, where we're sort of encouraged to really embrace what it means to be Black and what it means to be African American, while also embracing what it means to be a woman and having like the full freedom to embody both of those identities simultaneously, while also understanding the challenges. So it wasn't like, you know, this Pollyanna, everything's going to be perfect. It's not that. It's just more of a standing firm and grounded in those identities. So that way you're able to take on whatever the world throws at you.
Okay, I'm going to, this reverse thing, I think I'd go next, but someone, I'm 60, so anybody can get ahead of me on this one if you want to. I don't mind being very upfront about my age. It's my age. And I'm really, I mean, Tiffany, I'm so happy the way you grew up, because it wasn't how I grew up. I grew up in a very sexist household with extremely thick gender roles. And really for most of my life until I came out, even as a lesbian, of course, you can have kids as a lesbian. I actually had relatives who said, oh, I guess you're not gonna have kids. Really, you're talking about that one? But most of my 20s, the only questions family members asked me is, when are you getting married and how many kids do you want? Mm. Not, how are you doing in college? What degree do you have? What are your aspirations? What good do you wanna do in the world? No, it was about, are you associated with a man and your intention to reproduce? And I was just as outspoken then as I am now, and I had to find lots of ways to express myself, and it did mean losing family members. There are family members I have not talked to in 40 years because of how thick this sexism is. It also taught me early on that where there is sexism, there is racism, and where there is racism, there is homophobia. And that circle of identity, and it's connected in the tissue, is thick and connected, and they are connected together. So it was an interesting evolution for me that instead of it overwhelming me, it solidified my commitment to social justice and my commitment to how I was committed to education as being how I wanted to change the world, because I could see in its soul-killing effects that the only thing you're seeing as a woman is your association with a man and reproduction is, in my mind, is a reductionist view of life. And I'm just so happy to hear you younger people that maybe you've got different spaces and places, because to me, isn't that the core of a woman's movement? Is that for all women? So thanks. And by the way, it may be tougher and stronger, and we can be defined by things, or we can define things. And I'm proud of what I overcame. I wish I didn't have to, but those were my times, and I think the times of many women.
So guys, I am in no way acknowledging my age by this order. In fact, I'm going to perform the evidence that I have internalized sexism by quoting Mae West, a woman who will tell her age will tell anything. But so, having said that, I think that I too, even though my parents were not of the same age demographic as Tiffany's parents, I just give so much credit to my mom and dad. So my mom and dad came up from the South during the Great Migration. They were kids, you know, they were like teenagers. Mom was 18, dad was 19. Dad went to work in Reynolds Aluminum in a steel mill. And, you know, and they were kids, and yet they were like armchair activists. And so, you know, I was saying to another group, and we had James Baldwin on the little hand-me-down coffee table that we had. And I am the middle child in between two brothers. So I have middle child syndrome, which means I was both an overachiever and an enforcer. You know, I was, you know, a proud, you know, tattler in terms of making sure that my brothers did what I thought they should. I also was like a 10-year-old feminist in that I insisted that my brothers had to do the chores. You know, we had turns, and it wasn't going to be all me. And I have to say, my parents always helped me enforce it, you know, to the extent they could. And my mom, who was my best friend, totally different from me in terms of sensibility. Very utilitarian and, you know, no adornment, whereas I came to the planet wanting jewelry and, you know, you know, everything had to be prissy and pretty. And my mom totally indulged me. She never limited me to a script or a blueprint. She never tried to force me to even be like her. She always let me be myself. They gave all of us a huge sort of sense of confidence, which I know can be off-putting for some people. And my mother used to say, when Dini grows up, she's going to be sending rockets to the moon. Now, I'm telling my age by that because, you know, space travel was, you know, a big thing. But that's how much support we had, and yet we were always raised never to hold ourselves above anyone. And so a lot of our friends were people that, you know, had less, because we just had this natural tendency to be, you know, sort of activists and to look out for people who needed advocacy. But they also raised us not to necessarily submit to anyone. And so, you know, we never in our mindset never felt that white people were better or that anyone was better based on race or economic status. And yet, I mean, because I was an overachiever, I was, you know, the valedictorian of my junior high class, and I was always in, they were called accelerated classes in my school system, but, you know, in honors programs. And in that environment, away from home, I was treated like an interloper as a girl, you know, because most of the people who were the top in the class were boys. And so there was always tension, you know, because here I was, and I wasn't going anywhere, but, you know, sort of like, why are you here? And so it was, you know, it was a mixed bag for me, but I do. I mean, I just thank my parents so much for, you know, for being the modernists that they were, as they helped us navigate the world and you know, just have a sense of pride and identity. So, Catherine, you had a story to tell?
Yeah. I grew up in a suburban community in Connecticut. It was actually a little farm town that became a suburb. Mm-hmm. Kind of sort of sounds familiar if you're here in the Midwest, because that's what happened here too. But my mom was a single mom. My mother was a lesbian, and she had a partner for most of her life, which was extremely rare. So I was raised by two women. So there wasn't the internal household kinds of things. And my father lived in Denver and I lived in Connecticut. So it wasn't like I got that sexist kind of thing. However, when I was in high school, and, you know, what are you going to be when you grow up? I wanted to be a lawyer. You know, that's what I wanted to be. And I was told by my parents, you know, it just ain't going to happen because they don't let women into law school. Mm. And, you know, you know, where, you know, our biggest, obviously our biggest university was Yale. We were, you know, but New Haven was just, we were a suburb of New Haven. And, you know, then the places in New York and Boston and stuff. So when I graduated from high school and tried college, I honestly didn't know what I wanted to be, because what I wanted to be, I couldn't be. The Civil Rights Act that was passed a year after I graduated from high school, and then took, as far as I was concerned, another decade to really work on any level. And I will say, as far as I can tell, and we all know the Howard K. Smith story, and if we don't, I'm sure Dr. Kent would love to fill us in, but you know, the biggest benefactor in the early years of the Civil Rights Act were white women, period. And I know that because I finally graduated from college in 1979. I didn't start until I was almost 30. And I went to law school. Now, when I went to law school, 1/3 of my class were women. Okay? The woman who became my mentor later in life as a lawyer, she graduated high school 5 years earlier than I did. So she was 5 years older. She went and graduated university. She did a couple of other things. And then she wanted to go to law school too. So she applied to the University of Chicago. There were two women in her class. So that difference between her starting in what I figure was like 1968, 1969, and my starting in 79, it took those 10 years, but it happened. The thing that hadn't happened, and that's why I know women benefited from this in a way that African Americans didn't, is in the whole, our first 1L, that's the first year of law school, we had over 300 students in 1L. DePaul Law School was one of the largest law schools in the nation. My section had 100 people. Not one of whom was black. Not one. We had a black students club in the law school, but if there were 10 people in that club, I'd be surprised. So about 1,200 students throughout the law school, and probably less than 1% were African American. That's sort of the story there, because for a white girl growing up in a white neighborhood during white times, that was eye-opening. The other thing I'll tell you, so it throws a little bit, I became a civil rights lawyer. That was my focus, employment, civil rights, and stuff like that. So, on a whole lot of other levels, the Civil Rights Act helped me pay for law school.
Thank you all. I always say that my favorite part about being the Women's Center Director is hanging out and hearing stories from so many fabulous women. So I really appreciated that part. So we're coming near the end of our panel, and we're running a bit tight on time. So we're just going to ask real quick, and I know that one of our panelists had to step away, but what would you hope to see change in societal attitudes and expectations in the next 25 years? So looking at the future, what would you like to see continue to change or change in attitudes towards women?
I I can start, I guess. So again, because we got the questions ahead of time, it allowed for a little bit of thought. But I thought of things like less shaming of women, more supporting diverse experiences with regard to womanhood, less policing of women's bodies and young girls' bodies. I mean, this stuff starts in schools and then just continues on into adulthood, right? So when we enact school-based policies about things like wearing tank tops, the length of shorts, et cetera, we start policing girls' bodies really early. And then that just continues on into adulthood. So those are some of the things that I would like to see us make continued progress on. I would like to also see us raising our boys to recognize when those things are happening in school. So I'm a mom of a boy. So I always like to tell this funny story that after his school district passed the tank top policy, I wouldn't allow him to wear tank tops to school anymore. They don't call them tank tops for boys, but you get the point. Like, I wouldn't allow him to wear them anymore either. And so, you know, he's asking why, because he's like 10 years old. And he's like, what? Why can't I wear this? And I said, well, if girls' shoulders are erotic, then certainly boys' shoulders are also erotic. So it's just raising your boys to understand and your young men to understand that these sorts of things are largely illogical, because both sexes, genders, they both have shoulders. So the shoulder on one person should not be any more erotic than the shoulders on another. So I think there are ways that we can raise our children to understand these sort of inequities.
If I can jump in, I would like to see, and I would say this affects all women, including white women, the stereotyping around the status of being a woman. And all women, I think, including white women, are equally harmed. And so I'm thinking in particular the idea of women as value objects for the male gaze, to use, you know, that overworked term, or just in general in terms of even beyond heteronormativity, just the idea of value and beauty. And so in particular for, you know, for Black women, this idea that, you know, that you are just not as desirable. I remember once having some friends who were quite open about their conversations when they were talking in groups of men only. And one of my friends said that he was in a conversation in the pool hall, and these were all Black men, and they were talking about women who were attractive in popular culture. And somebody mentioned a Black woman, and one of the guys said, man, I'm not talking about a pejorative word. I'm talking about a woman. Like, you know, well, there are these categories. And of course, you know, there are certain people that don't ascend to a universal beauty standard. So women who are Latin are burdened by certain stereotypes. Women who are Asian American are burdened by certain stereotypes. White women are burdened by certain stereotypes. And I think it has a really profound effect on Black women, because whether you are straight or gay, young or old, the chances that a Black woman will have a partnership or significant opportunities for a partnership are much, much, I think, less than is true for, I think, just about anyone else. And that narrows even more when you're in communities like Springfield. And so, I mean, that sounds sort of superficial, but, you know, I think it's a quality of life issue ultimately. And if that could change, I never got over Janet Jackson and the wardrobe malfunction and, you know, Justin Timberlake being rewarded and while she was punished. I mean, there's just so many narratives you can point to.
I think for me, I would like to see more empowerment for women and less sexualization, less harassment, less governing over our bodies. And most importantly, I would like to see more women in politics.
Real quick, I would say the biggest thing all of us face is white male supremacy. It just really pisses me off. And I don't, you know, I mean, when I look at Congress, there's a few women now. There's a few, you know, this, that, and the other thing. There's a little progress. And that's what I want to keep going. So what I want to see and what my future is, and I have two young women in my life who are extremely important to me. They're like my kids. One of them is a young, well, to me, young African-American woman. She is now the alder woman of the 49th Ward in Chicago. I mean, she beat a white asshole. Excuse my French. I'm sorry. You'll have to cut that. And I actually was a bad guy. That's the continuing changes I want to see, is I want to see women of color, Black, Latina, Asian, whatever, white, everybody but women take over half the world, please, at least half. We can, no, we're a majority. So I think we should have 55% and leave the other 45% to men. And my hope is at least that women truly, truly have power and power to change things, and that they start believing in themselves, because we still see women out there who don't fight for themselves, who feel that men are superior and that they have to listen to them. You know, many of the suffragettes who were fighting in 1920, and many of them who kept fighting until 1964, or until the Equal Rights, third, fourth, fifth Equal Rights Amendment was passed again. They wanted women to truly be equal in this world. And that's what I want. And that's what I see happening. And so that's what I want for young people. Take it.
And if I could just say, Rex, as I'm doing Title IX workshops, I often weave in a bit of history, particularly when I'm making a presentation to first-year students for whom a lot of these concepts may be new. And one of the things I point out is that sexual assault was a property crime in law until, you know, fairly recently in historical terms. So, you know, this idea that women were property, they either belonged to their father, who, you know, would provide a dowry for them to be, taken by a man in marriage, or either belong to their husband. And the whole idea of damaged goods, you know, that, you know, now you're not as valuable as property to be conveyed to enrich, you know, my homestead. And so I think, you know, that's not that long ago in historical terms. So thinking about what Dr. Eisenhardt just said, and, you know, and where we are and where we want to be, a lot of ground has been covered, and yet it's still sort of scary how much work has to be done.
And I appreciate that final point, Deanie, because one of the things I wanted to bookend this with for our HA students who are watching this later is that this is not that long ago. I often, when folks talk about the women's rights movement being so long ago, I point out that my mother was the youngest of six girls, and she was the first one who could get a credit card without her husband's signature when she graduated from high school.
Yeah.
None of my aunts could do so until right around the time she graduated from high school. So it's not so very long ago that these things, I have memories of speaking to a great grandmother whose age predated the 19th Amendment. So we need to look back, and that's why I love this panel, is it's such a diverse group of backgrounds and experiences and ages, and seeing just different perspectives. So I want to thank you all for participating. It was really great discussion. I think this is where I talk about voting.
Yes.
Okay, so sorry, don't edit that part out. Okay. So If you watch this presentation and you feel so inclined, and we hope you do, we hope that you get involved with the voting process here, 2020 being the 100th anniversary of women's right to vote. And I believe I figured out it is the 55th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act as well this year, 1965 to 2020. If I can do math correctly, that is correct. So I'm going to share on my screen just a couple of resources for you all to know about. This is the UIS Votes Voter Information. This will be put out to all of the students, but it includes some important information for you all to have. October 18th being the online voter registration deadline, October 28th, the deadline to request vote by mail. You may do early voting October 19th through November 2nd, and of course, mark your calendars for November 3rd, Election Day. It is now a holiday, so if you are inclined to vote in person and feel safe doing so, please do so. Upcoming voter registration drives on campus, actually Constitution Day, which is what this presentation honors, is one of the first drives, as well as Voter Registration Day, September 22nd. And you can register online at studentvote.org. And so there's some other things about ways of voting on here. And this will be regularly put into campus announcements. If you feel like getting very involved in the voting process, we need your help to be a campus election ambassador. So you're gonna help, if you're so inclined, you're gonna help students navigate voter registration, early voting and voting by mail, and training is gonna be provided. So if you're interested in doing this, you can submit your interest form at bit.do/UISvotes or contact the Volunteer Center at volunteer@uis.edu. And this is just a great opportunity to get involved in this process. For many of you, I know this is gonna be your first chance to vote in a presidential election, which is very exciting. So I hope that you take this historic opportunity. And finally, here's some more resources, and I'm actually gonna let Pamela chime in because she knows the most about this.
Sure. The library put together a guide on UIS. It's called UIS Votes, but it's really about voting. And it's everything you need to know about the election. It's dates, information from different states. Maybe you're voting in absentia from another state, which you've decided to maintain your residency in. There's just a ton of information on that guide. And to complement Dr. Kent's talk, I have I am actually the women's studies librarian, and so I have made it my business to purchase some books purchased for the library. So those of you who want to pursue further knowledge in this area, we have some publications here. The first one here, Carrie Chapman Catt, was actually originally published in 1926 and then republished in 2006. But these others are all 2020 copyright dates, so they're very current scholarship. Thank you very much to our panelists for your contributions and for your time. And thank you, Roxanne, for being a partner in this this wonderful event. And thank you, Dr. Kent, for that absolutely extremely informative lecture.